Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We are going to consider the seasonal changes with our friend, Julie Zicafous, artist, author, blogger. What have I left out? Julie Zicafous, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. I was laughing and saying you certainly didn't leave out seamstress because I can't sew.
Oh, I bet you if you tried, you probably could.
Oh, I tried. My mother made me take a sewing class when I was in high school, and it was a disaster.
So, let's see. Artist, author, naturalist, blogger. We learn a lot about you from your blog, and you have a philosophy about your blog. You like to keep it upbeat, positive, yeah. But you were frustrated in a recent one regarding invasive species, one in particular. I had to look it up. A certain kind of decorative grass that it's killing you.
Yeah. It's, you know, every once in a while I just kind of have a little mini breakdown. And as you said, I try to keep the blog as positive as possible. I want it to be a resort for people to go to when the news of the world gets them down. And but there are a lot of invasive plants that really drive me crazy. And one is an Asian grass called Miscanthus. And I think what we have here is sort of a hybrid of all those ornamental Miscanthus grasses that people plant often around condo developments. People call them pampas grass and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And there's one variety called Morning Light with a white midrib. And way back in the early 90s, I thought it was pretty, and I planted it all over my yard. And when I saw it throwing seedlings out in the meadow, I killed every one of them. Mm-hmm. I've done this a lot of times. You know, it's like you suddenly get this plant that turns out to be a thug, and so then I do a zero tolerance where I eliminate every single one, because what I don't want to do is seed the wild habitats here with my stuff.
And it's taking over, at least in your area, places where you had formerly been able to find your rose pink, which is your birthday flower.
Yeah, my birthday flower is a Sabbatia angularis, or rose gentian or rose pink, and it's just such a beautiful, fragrant flower. And yeah, there are now, I can think of three different rose pink locations that are now solid grass, this Miscanthus grass. And the insidious thing about this grass is that it comes in wherever there's disturbed soil. So anytime anybody does some bulldozing, this windborne seed settles gently on that area, and you suddenly, over the course of the next year or two, get this, 10-foot high impenetrable wall of clumps of razor-edged grass. And it blows my mind how fast this stuff can ruin habitat. So, yeah, every once in a while I rant, but I try to rant in a way that will maybe wake people up and get them to stop planting this stuff in their yards.
You did find a nice big patch, though, right, of the rose pink?
Oh, yeah, secret patch in a power line cut. And one of the kind of fun things about rose pink is that it does depend on us to keep mowing. And I found this in a power line cut that had been mowed a couple years ago and, you know, brush hogged. And the stuff just went wild in there, 75 plants in there. And I was so happy. It was like the best birthday present ever.
And I love the surprise you wrote about it in your blog, how you're... daughter, you got to make the icing because you wanted to make a certain color icing, which is like really interesting. And but she took the icing and the cake, and she put together something pretty special for you.
Yeah, she topped it with rose pink all over it. This is a birthday tradition in our family. Those of us with summer birthdays always get flower cakes, and we try to get, you know, we try to. We are not pastry chefs. You know, this is not fancy stuff, but we do put beautiful flowers from our gardens on the cakes, and there's no better cake decoration.
Is it edible?
I don't know. Given that a lot of the gentians have medicinal properties, I recommended that people not eat it.
Because medicinal can cut both ways.
Yeah, exactly. Who knows what that means?
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest this hour, Julie Zicafous, author, artist, blogger, naturalist. If you have a question or comment about this, what's going on outside, give us a call, because Julie always likes to kind of ponder it with you. 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You are a trained wildlife rehabilitator. We always have to mention that because It's not just happenstance that a lot of your blogs involve the saving of wild animals.
Absolutely, yeah. And I'm very careful to make sure I have both state and federal permits up to date to handle and help birds. That's what I try to do, is help them.
Now, you found one recently, a little bluebird, a baby bluebird. You've had experiences with baby bluebirds before. In fact, you named a book after that, The Bluebird Effect.
Right. And I like to think that as I get older, my little voice that tells me where to go and what path to walk down is getting stronger. And for some reason on this day, I went and checked a bluebird box that was on a far-flung property from here, and it was on one of my favorite running routes. And I walked up to it, and I could see right away there was something wrong. There was a naked little baby bluebird right at the hole of the box, and it was begging. And in the back of the box with my flashlight, I could see there was a nest with three siblings who were, you know, back there and fine. And I thought, oh, that's weird for this bird to be right out of the nest cup. And it's a very strange decorative box. It's a horizontal box. So the bird had built a nest way in the back of it, and this baby was sort of stranded at the front. And I stuck my pinky in, and I felt it, and it was cold to the touch, and I knew that it was in trouble. So I had to get that bird out. I couldn't get it back in the nest cup, so I gently extracted it and put it in my sports bra, which is a great place to carry a baby bird, and brought it home. It peeped all the way.
You pondered something, though, in that blog. It might have been that one, or maybe a subsequent one, about what nature intends. And yeah. I thought that was interesting.
Yeah. There was something going on with this bird, and the female bluebird had picked up on that. And so she had ousted it from the nest. And, of course, being a human being whose heart gets in the way every time, I said, well, there may be something wrong with it, but I'm going to see if I can help it. So I took it home and fed it all day, and it got a bunch stronger. It still was kind of shaky and a little bit trembly and hyperactive. But I thought, you know, I'm going to try and put this in a nest box in my field here that I can monitor, and if there's anything truly wrong with the bird, I can then get it back out of there. And so that's what I did. I stuck it in with a brood of babies that was only a day older than it.
I thought it was interesting you brought up the issue about mothers kicking baby birds out of the nest. It's sort of part of this old saying, but there might be a reason for it.
Yeah. This is something that I've come to kind of late in life, the realization that old wives' tale, oh, it got kicked out of the nest, you know. And I always thought, oh, come on, you know, it probably just fell. But the more I deal with baby birds, and I raise them and feed them and rehabilitate them, that have been found on the ground with no explanation, the more I realize that there's usually an issue with the bird that was easy for the parent to sense. And in the sort of seemingly heartless way of nature, the parent bird will just say, out with you. So I actually had what I'm almost convinced is an attempted genocide in a house wren in one of my boxes. I had, from the very start, a runt that was naked, not feathering out, looked terrible, really skinny. And I thought, well, that's weird. And so I watched this bird over a number of days, and I actually even gave it a few supplemental feedings to see if I could maybe help it along. But then one day I came in, and I opened the box, and I found that the parent house wren had stuffed a walking stick down this thing's throat. That was...
A walking stick?
Yeah,
insect. The insect. Okay.
Right. That was like 2 inches long. And the baby was valiantly attempting to swallow it, couldn't. And there it sat with this walking stick sticking out. And I thought, that kind of looks like they meant to do that. Subsequently, the baby disappeared. I took the walking stick out and gave it some more appropriate food. But by the next day, the baby was simply gone. And I'm sure that the house wren had said, okay, we tried that. That didn't work. Out you go.
Wow.
Yeah. So they do that.
Asia in Westerville, you're on the air with Julie Zickafoos. Hi, Asia.
Hi. Hi, Julie. Hi, Anne.
Hey.
I had a question about the morning light miscanthus. What alternatives would you suggest for people who want a pretty ornamental grass? And I was also wondering if the morning light cultivar is the only variety of that miscanthus grass that's invasive.
Oh, yeah. Sorry to sort of finger one variety as the thug. I would have to say that any of the perennial miscanthus varieties are going to be a problem because they set seed, and the seed is windborne. The grass that is currently invading us is a miscanthus. It's from Asia. It's probably Miscanthus sinensis. As far as I know, it came from the current problem came from a little country cemetery on my road where people would take the plumy tops, and they thought they were pretty, and they put them in the cemetery bouquets.
Mm.
And it has spread crazily from that one hot spot. I would say that any of the perennial miscanthus grasses with the plumy heads are going to be a problem, potentially. What I would recommend instead is grasses I'm crazy about are little Penicetum grasses. I have one called Fireworks right now that is bright red and striped, and the beauty of these is that they're annuals, and they die back. They don't survive the winter.
Okay.
So they give you the same kind of feeling, maybe not on as grand a scale, but they're very beautiful grasses, and certainly there are lots of prairie grasses that are native that are gorgeous. Big blue stem, Indian grass, things like that that you can plant that will be perennial, that may spread, but they're prairie native. So, you know, they're never going to be the thugs that these Asian grasses will be.
Asia, thanks for that call. Thanks for that great question. We got an email from Peter. Let's go to that. I want to put a bluebird house in my backyard, and I have two questions. Would I have a better chance of attracting bluebirds to the house by placing it on a pole, under tree, leaf color, or out in the open, not under a tree?
Well, mounting a bluebird box on a pole is always the best idea because then you can fit the pole with a predator baffle. And I recommend a stovepipe baffle. And that is something that you can often buy at a wild bird store or simply make. I have easy plans in a booklet that I wrote called Enjoying Bluebirds More. And that's available from Birdwatchers Digest by dialing 1-800-TRY-BIRD. That's T-R-Y, bird. Anyway, mount it on a pole. For bluebirds, don't put it under a tree. There is always the possibility that a rat, snake, squirrel, mouse, flying squirrel, something like that, will drop onto the box, even if it is baffled, and raid the nest. So put it out in the open. Bluebirds like as much mown lawn around their nest as possible. So open areas, away from trees and shrubs where house wrens might lurk. House wrens like to go in and pierce bluebird eggs and throw them out. So you want to keep it away from shrubbery. This booklet that I mentioned, Enjoying Bluebirds More, gives you everything you need to know to put up a bluebird box, to situate it properly, and to care for it.
We'll put that number on our website at wosu.org/allsides, so you can just go to the page for this episode of the show. And then Peter asks, once the structure is up, what's the best way to attract bluebirds to it?
Well, the best way to attract bluebirds to a house is not to paint it a certain color or face it a certain way, but to simply have it in habitat that they like. So, you know, it's almost magic, but not quite. If you don't have bluebirds in your area, if you haven't seen them, it might be a bit of a long shot. However, if you see them going through your yard, if you've seen them in the area, just putting it in an open area and mounting it safely is the best. There's no too late or too early time to put one up. You can put one up this time of year in time for what I call the fall house hunting that bluebirds do. It's so cute. They, on beautiful days in the fall, they'll go in and out of boxes, in and out of boxes, usually the juveniles saying, well, this is nice. This is like where I grew up. I could use this. It's really cute. And there's a lot of that goes on in October. And they also roost in them all winter long. So no, there's no wrong time to put up a bluebird box.
All right. You're listening to Julie Zicafoos, naturalist, artist, and author, a great friend of All Sides with Ann Fisher. If you have a question or comment for her, give her a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. With us today, Julie Zicafoos, naturalist, artist, and author. Been on many times. If you have a question or comment for her, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Now, I never get tired, Julie Zicafoos, of your stories of rescue. I never do. I mean, it's just every single one, you make them so distinctive. But at the end of your blog post on the baby bird, you suggested that the importance of getting these kinds of stories out there, you know, is great. Why is sharing these stories so important?
Well, I've discovered over the years that making a personal connection with an individual animal or bird is the single most powerful way to empathize and understand with the species as a whole. And I've seen it happen so many times, like at a banding demonstration in Arizona a few years ago that I attended. I saw a fellow who was banding hummingbirds, and he would give it to someone in the crowd to hold for the release. And the transformation in these people, it was like there was an electric current going through them, you know, that they got to touch this thing. And I try to do that with my stories, where you realize that it's not just birds tweeting around out there. It's individuals, and each one of them with its own sort of self-determination and wisdom and goals and personality. And I think it's really important to connect in that visceral, intimate way with creatures and with nature.
Paul in Reynoldsburg, you're on the air with Julie Zicafoos. Hi, Paul.
Good morning, Ann. Good morning, Julie.
Good morning.
I got a strange question, but I was out at Big Darby Canoe Livery a few years ago, and they've got a little rapid coming down Big Darby Creek just into the canoe livery, and there was a group of white swans, and they would ride this rapid down, and then they would all fly back to the beginning of it and ride it again over and over. Now, why I'm asking about this is I recently heard, it was either on NPR Science Friday or maybe Nature Show, and they said birds and reptiles do not play, only mammals play.
Oh, phooey. What a bunch of crud.
I'm surprised. Hasn't anyone ever watched? Well, I mean, sometimes you wonder if it's territorial or not, but it seems like they play.
Oh, my goodness. There are so many videos. There was a jackdaw somewhere in Europe riding a jar lid down a roof.
Oh, yes, I've seen
snowy
that.
A roof, yeah. And then flying back up to the top with the jar lid and riding it down. And, you know, not only tool using, but obviously having a ball.
Well, what about the dancing cockatiels?
Oh, the cockatoos?
Oh,
yeah.
Cockatoos, okay.
That have incredible rhythm.
Yeah.
And they also have a sense for how to make their people laugh. I lived with a macaw for 23 years, and those things have a sense of humor like you would not believe. Sense of humor, playfulness, pointless behaviors, all this stuff birds do. And why the scientific community has, and I'm not going to say all of them, but some in the scientific community have been reluctant to grant birds the same kind of sentience and playfulness that we readily grant otters and dogs and cats, mystifies me because blue jays, for example, are probably almost as smart as chimpanzees. So why wouldn't play come as part of the package with that kind of brain power?
Thank you, Paul, for raising that issue. What fun that must have been to see those swans.
Fantastic.
Let's see. Oops. Julie in Grandview, you're on the air. Hi, Julie.
Hi. I'm actually in Grandview, but I live in Groveport, and I have spoken with Julie, or rather text, back and forth on a few occasions. I have 5 acres, and I've had some bird issues. But last summer, we had chimney swifts in a chimney that is attached to the summer kitchen at our place. And it's not very frequently used, so we were fine not using it. But during one of the rainstorms, the babies washed down to the floor of the fireplace. And I called Julie, and she gave me some great advice on how to feed them and stuff. And we ended up just blocking the whole thing off so the mother would read that whole chimney as part of the chimney. And she must have come down and fed them because we continued to hear them for weeks, it seemed like, until I guess they fledged. So here's my question. Why did they not come back?
The chimney swifts.
Yeah.
Well, sometimes when a bird has a nest failure in a place, and I would say the nest falling down is a near nest failure, even though those babies survived it, they will not come back and nest in the same location.
Hmm. It was never more than that.
Uh-huh. Well, what a lot of people don't realize about chimney swifts is that there's only one per chimney, usually. Did you have two nests simultaneously in the same chimney?
We did, but our neighbors also had chimney swifts, and we would go in the evening and watch what seemed like hundreds descend down that chimney.
Yes, but that is distinct from nesting. That would be an autumnal roosting behavior. And that's what gives people the impression that they can have colonies of chimney swifts in their chimneys. But when springtime comes and they're territorial, it's one pair per chimney. So, yeah, I mean, a lot of us have gotten, and I grew up with the assumption that, you know, if you had a chimney swift, it could be just full of chimney swift nests, but no. That's why it's kind of interesting when people build these enormous chimney swift nesting towers, and I'm thinking, wow, that's a big bird box for one pair of chimney swift. But, you know, it's pretty cool to be able to do that. I remember that instance, and I'm really, really glad that those babies made it. That's wonderful. Chimney swifts actually fledge the nest. They crawl out of the nest at around 12 days old. So they are crawling all over the inside of that chimney, so it's not so unusual that the parent would come and feed them wherever they happen to be.
Julie, thanks for that call. You are listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is Julie Zicafus, naturalist, artist, and author. She joins us to talk about what's happening in the late summer and anything else you want to talk about regarding nature. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You know, I was thinking about what the last caller said about how she's contacted you and texted you or maybe gone on Facebook or whatever and talked to you. And you responded to her, and you had an open house for your gardens recently, and you said that one of the high points of that is seeing people, you know, three-dimensionally, and they respond. They responded. So tell us about your little party.
That was super fun. It was actually kind of like a leap of faith for me because although I have a fairly public social media presence, I'm actually kind of private about my home. So I was kind of dithering about whether I wanted to open it up to the public. And then I thought, well, you know, this is kind of hard to get to. And if you had ill intent or, you know, you probably wouldn't take all that time to travel there. And I thought, just relax, Julie, just make an event. Let's just do this. So I did it and it was super, super fun. And, I was just thinking my one regret is that I did not make everyone introduce themselves so I could, like, connect names with faces. Mm-hmm. I wish I had said, I want to meet you all personally, but there were 53 people here, so it was a little hard to do that. But we had a blast, and basically I led a tour at 12:30, and it went till 2, and then I started over. I did a 2 to 5, and then I collapsed and thought, well, that was fun. It's a lot of work, but I'm doing the work anyway, you know, maintaining the gardens and getting everything ready.
614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Back to invasive plant species. Karen and Hilliard, you're on the air. Hi.
Hi. I'm originally from the South and have never run across this. We've run across it in a community garden. When it comes out of the ground, it's dark, dark, dark red. And if you, the leaf, if you imagine a sort of like a marijuana leaf, only like 10 or 15 times bigger.
Hmm.
And
oh.
If you let it go, it'll get as tall as the house.
Oh, yeah.
And it seems to be a thug because we pull it up and pull it up and it keeps coming back.
Kind of sounds like castor bean.
Hmm.
Possibly. Has a palmate leaf, as you said, like a marijuana leaf. Red stems. It is the plant whose seeds are used to make ricin, which is R-I-C-I-N, which is that hideous toxic stuff that people were putting on subways in Japan years ago. Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah, right.
Yeah, yeah. It's incredibly toxic, and you have to eat part of the plant or the seeds. But incredibly toxic things tend to have no natural enemies. So, you know, it's not like anything's going to graze this down. It kind of sounds like castor bean to me, and that's another plant that I have a zero tolerance on here. Not that I've ever planted it, but my neighbor did, and I see it all over her yard.
Huh. You know, I'm just looking it up. That's really interesting. I've never seen anything like that before, but there are questions. Someone says they had a question about it, and they really like it, and it's really pretty, and the respondent saying, yeah, no, pull it up,
no.
Kill it.
Just don't. Yeah, I had a friend recently say, can you get me a teasel head? And I said, well, what are you going to do with it? And he didn't say. And I said, well, no, I'm not going to send you a teasel head because you're probably going to plant it. And it's a terrible invasive. So,
right.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Karen, thanks a lot for that call. It's interesting. I am going first to Barb, I hope. Barb, you're on the air with Julie Zickafoos. Hi, Barb.
Good morning, ladies.
Go ahead.
I have a question. Usually around my property, every summer, I have a lot of blue jays and cardinals. This summer, I have had a large population of mockingbirds and no blue jays and cardinals until about 2 weeks ago. The mockingbirds have disappeared, and now my cardinals and blue jays are back. Can you tell me why that is?
Well, whether or not those events are related is a little hard to say. When you say large population of mockingbirds, mockingbirds are among the most highly territorial of any of our species, so usually it's one pair per yard.
Dozens come through my yard.
Dozens of mockingbirds.
Could they be?
Right.
Could they?
Okay, we're sure they're mockingbirds.
I'm pretty sure they're either a mockingbird or a catbird. I really couldn't tell the difference, but I have never seen that many up until this year. And when they were here, the cardinals or blue jays weren't.
Okay. I'm going to say that those two events are not related. And I'm also going to guess that they might be catbirds if you've had that many in one area. Catbirds are solid gray, no other color except a little patch of reddish under the tail. Mockingbirds have brilliant white patches in wings and tail, and they sing a lot. And so they should be easy to distinguish between mockingbirds and catbirds. But as I said, I don't think that the sudden fluctuation in your bird populations has anything to do with the presence of mockingbirds or catbirds in this case.
Okay. Barb, thanks a lot for that call. And Tony, where are you? In Grove City, Tony? Where?
L-O-R-E.
Oh, where's that at?
That is about 8 miles from Cambridge and Guernsey County.
Well, hello from Cambridge and Guernsey County. Go ahead, Tony.
Yes, I moved here about a little over a year ago, and we're on a 3.5-acre place, and about 1.5 to 2 acres of it is a field that a man kept mowing, and we're in the process of turning it into a meadow to be beneficial to the birds, the bees, and the butterflies. And I've done real good with the bees and the butterflies, but I'm wondering what, and I want it to be like more like a meadow, and I don't want a bunch of like bushes all over the place. So
right.
I'm wondering what we could plant into it or what we could do in it that would help the birds that would be meadow birds?
Well, all you really have to do to keep a meadow useful to birds is you got to keep mowing it. Like March is probably a good time to mow because you're going to take the wood down, but you will not ruin any winter cover, and you won't take any nests out if you mow in March. So mowing, timing is always tough. You know, you're like, oh, well, gosh, I don't want to remove. Basically, leaving winter cover standing is the best thing you can do for the birds with the autumn coming on, because the birds are going to eat the seed heads of the flowers and everything that are there. I have been hand-pulling the sumac that's coming into my prairie patch because it's just going to take over. So you want to watch that woody stuff because while sumac is a very useful wildlife plant, it will create a monoculture, and you don't want that. So you got to mow enough to sort of keep that woody stuff from completely taking over.
Sumac's not invasive, though, right?
Sumac is invasive, absolutely.
Oh, it is.
But there's a distinction between invasive and exotic. And, I mean, there are plenty of native plants that are extremely invasive.
Okay.
Trumpet creeper is one. Sumac is another. These are plants that are just, they're thugs, you know. They spread by underground rhizomes and roots, and they will take over. So, yeah, invasive is a term that can easily be applied to native
okay.
as well.
Mm-hmm. All right. Okay. So, Tony, thanks a lot for that. Have fun with that 3 acres. What a blast. You know, I was wanted to ask you, and maybe I have before and I've forgotten, which, you know, is so sadly completely possible. And that's why you named your 80-acre place out there in Appalachia, Ohio, Indigo Hill.
Oh, well, Indigo Hill, because Bill and I were trying to figure out what to call the place. And we were tossing around names, and we were standing out on the deck, and an indigo bunting came flying over doing a flight song at dusk. And we looked at each other, and I said, Indigo Hill. It just came to me. So it's for the indigo buntings, who are common nesters in the borders of the meadow here. And also, Tony, I'd like to recommend my book, Natural Gardening for Birds, to you. That will give you, I know you asked what you could plant, and that's kind of a big topic. So I would highly recommend Natural Gardening for Birds, which is published by Skyhorse, and it should be easy to find. And you can also order it through my website.
Yeah, we'll have a link to Julie Zikafoos's website on ours at wosu.org/allsides. And if you want to catch up on that later, I've said before, you're prolific. You've done so many different things. You've written about so many different aspects of the natural world. You don't just limit it to birds, although birds could be, you know, completely
all consuming,
but you branch out. We will be right back. We have a lot more to talk about, so stay with us. If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513. I've got some emails here. You can send your email to allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. My guest is naturalist, artist, author Julie Zikafoos. We'll have a link to her website at wosu.org/allsides, so please check it out. There's lots to look at, lots to read. Julie Zikafoos, when you think about this time of year, what do you call it?
Wow, it's fall already for me. Mm-hmm. I also call it the time of bug music. bug music is my favorite thing. I just love it. And the cicada chorus that's swelling, especially in the evenings with the scissor grinder cicadas going rear, rear, rear. That's one of my favorite sounds in the world. Katydids at night. the screech owls are fledging now, so you can barely hear them, you know, whinnying over the sound of the cicadas and katydids. So to me, bugs reign supreme this time of year, and I just love it.
And one other thing, I want to get to these calls and emails, but do you notice a lot of our conversations, like let's go back 9 years almost nine years to when we first met by way of radio. I feel like so many more of the questions, the queries from the listeners have to do with naturalizing, have to do with, than they used to.
Yeah, making accommodations for wildlife, you know, making things more hospitable. I mean, I think it seems like when we first started out, we got a lot of, I have a woodpecker pecking holes in my siding.
Yes, I was trying to think of what the contrast was. And
Sure. It was nuisance wildlife questions. And now we get people saying, what can I plant? What can I do? How can I bring this closer? And that is a beautiful thing. Everything that's been planted in my garden, I've tried to think about wildlife utility as well as beauty. And so it's just a wonderful trend to encourage, I think.
Nancy in Grandview, you're on the air with Julie Zuckerfuss. Hi, Nancy.
Hi. I want to try to make my call quick because it's otherwise a long story. We were in northern Minnesota at a family cabin earlier this summer, and there's an eagle nest quite close to the cabin so we can keep an eye on it and enjoy it. What happened is that this adolescent eagle, for reasons unknown to us, fell from his nest, and we discovered him when we were out wading. It was a hot day, and he was all kind of crumpled at the base of his tree. And so we quickly tried to find somebody who could help us do what needed to be done or just learn how to watch him. Mm-hmm. And it was after hours, a terrible time to have a crisis like that. And it took us about 45 minutes to find the right resource, which was the Raptor Center in St. Paul, Minnesota. And
they have
volunteers who will come out and pick up injured eagles and take them back to St. Paul to be taken care of. And so talked to some really nice people there. And it was late in the evening. It was just before sundown. They said, take another look. Be sure he's okay. If he's still there, just leave him overnight, come back in the morning, and if he's alive, struggling, call us again. So then they said parents will oftentimes feed these young birds who fall from nests. And so anyway, it was kind of a windy day. He may have been on the verge of flying, we don't know. But we went out then just before sundown, and by golly, he had managed to fly himself out into the lake and was struggling. It was awful. He was, and his head would go down in the water. He's very weak, and then come back up. Anyway, we took it upon ourselves to row out to him, put a fish net in front of him, and he grabbed it and let us pull him back to the shore.
Wow.
Very interesting. And we had to lift him because he was just so weak. And we kind of just laid stuff over his bundle and tried to keep him warm. But I think he was, by that time, he was very cold. And we called Raptor Center back again. But by morning, he had died.
Oh, dear.
So my question to you is there some equivalent source in Ohio for eagles that we could get a hold of?
Right.
I think it would be nice if that were brought
knowledge.
Oh,
sure.
For goodness sake, yes. The Ohio Wildlife Center right in Columbus is ready and willing to help with all kinds of such problems. And I'm really sorry that your eagle didn't make it, but it sounds like there could have been an issue with this bird. Bad judgment at the very least. Fly out over the lake. But the Ohio Wildlife Center is taking in thousands of creatures every season and working so hard. And I'm telling you, if you have any spare money to donate, that would be the place. They are right on off the Sawmill Road exit, off 270, and they have a hotline with a toll-free number. But it's also owc.org online, their website. So that's our go-to resource in the area.
Okay. Nancy, thanks for that call. Chuck in Lewisburg, you're on the air. Hi, Chuck.
Hey, good morning, ladies. I have a question. I'm not opposed to the blue martins, but I would like to have more swallows because they stay around longer than the martins do. Any way to attract them?
Blue martins. You're talking about purple martins?
Purple martins, I'm sorry.
Uh-huh. And do you have purple martins in your house?
I do not. I do not. But my cousin, has them, and they just don't stay long enough. And I think the swallows stay longer. That's a bigger bang for my buck.
Well, actually, tree swallows are the only other box nesting swallow in Ohio, and they actually often leave after their first brood fledges in June, May or June. So I wouldn't say that there is a virtue in tree swallows over purple martins as far as staying around longer. All the swallows are obligate insectivores, meaning they have to eat these flying insects, and when the flying insect abundance drops, they go. So attracting tree swallows is very similar to attracting bluebirds, and that is that you've got to have lots of open area. Marsh helps too, and putting the box up on well-protected baffled poles and in an open area is the best way to attract them. Tree swallows and martins both like proximity to water, so a big body of water nearby is a huge attractant for both of those.
Thank you, Chuck, for that call. And now we're turning to Shetty in Worthington. Hi, Shetty.
Hi, Ann. How are you?
Good, thanks. How are you?
I'm good.
Good.
I have a quick question, and I've gone back to the chimney swifts. I have two clutches, I guess, every year in my chimney. It's a wood-burning fireplace, and I have been afraid to light a fire in that fireplace.
Oh, you mean even in the off-season you're afraid to light a fire?
Yes. I don't know if they leave a nest there.
Okay. Well, you have no worries, because once the chimney swifts have vacated, and it's easy to tell because the stops, that noise that the babies make, the chimney swift nest is one of the smallest functional nests out there. It's made of tiny twigs glued together with sticks, and it absolutely does not present a fire hazard, so don't worry about that. It would be house sparrows that make the big bulky nest that you would be worried about, but a chimney swift makes a very nice little sling that you don't need to worry about.
Shetty, thanks a lot for that call. What's in the background there, Julie?
I thought I'd give you some native sound effects here. I am caring for two fledgling blue jays who I am so looking forward to releasing. They were raised beautifully by the Ohio Wildlife Center, which I mentioned before. Mm-hmm. And these birds are in a tent in my garage, learning the ways of the wild, and I can't wait to release them. But I thought I'd give you a little fun. As I've been talking, one has been hopping on my head and shoulder and pecking my knee.
You're managing very well. I mean, we never would have known.
You never would have known I was being mobbed. But yeah, the one who's calling now is Caledonia, and is a pretty darn wonderful bird. They are my favorite birds, and it's a privilege to be in their presence.
Oh, Jemima.
I know. Yeah. What could be better than to have little substitute Jemimas for the end of the summer? And especially since my kids are fledging this summer.
Yes. Yes. But your kids like to come home.
They do. It's just that one of them is going to be gone for 9 months. And
I
can't stand the thought, but I'm going to have to get used to it. Yeah, they like to come home. And actually, Liam is coming home from WVU in Morgantown. He's coming home on Labor Day weekend, and it will be the last hurrah for Liam and Phoebe together, and I cannot wait.
Facebook message from Edith. She asks, do chimney swifts tend to fly in groups along with dragonflies? A few times we've had some kind of bird and dragonflies flying above and around our front yard, trying to figure out what kind of bird and why.
Ah, very cool. Well, you're picking up on the migration of the great green darner, which is Anax junius. I love that name. And that is one of the migratory dragonflies. And this time of year, you see them massing and flying in flocks, and it's a wonderful sight. Chimney swifts do migrate in groups. However, you usually see them more around dusk and dawn, usually dusk. So what you might be seeing along with the migrating dragonflies could be common nighthawks who are migrating right now and who feed on the great green darners. They are dragonfly specialists. They love them. So that could be it. They're migrating in great flocks right now.
Okay, and let's turn to Bill in Upper Arlington. You're on the air, Bill. Hi.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a finch feeder with the thistles in it, and some beautiful yellow finches show up. But then there are, like, red-headed finches almost. Mm-hmm. Is there such a thing as a red-headed finch? And they seem very much more aggressive than the yellows.
Yes, and they tweet a lot. Tweet, 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 tweet. Those are house finches. House finches are they're not native to Ohio. They originally were native to California, west of the Mississippi. And along about the late 1930s, there was a couple of crates that were released at LaGuardia Airport, I believe. They were being flown in as pets. They were called Hollywood linnets, and people kept them in cages because they sang. And it was illegal to do this, and so some pet dealers on Long Island and this airport release created our eastern population of house finches. And all of our house finches east of the Mississippi are thought to be descended from a couple hundred birds. And the problem there is that they are very inbred, and they're very susceptible to disease. So you'll often see them showing up with big, swollen eyes at your feeders, and that's called house finch disease. And it is a dreaded, awful disease that afflicts many other birds, and blue jays are very susceptible. So I have actually quit feeding, even though my goldfinches were gorgeous. They were catching this disease from the house finches.
Oh.
So I quit feeding in the summer because this is the time that it spreads like wildfire. I had mentioned that they were inbred. They have no resistance to this disease, so house finches just get it. It's called mycoplasma.
Hmm.
So it might behoove you to think about that, to watch for disease in your house finches, big swollen eyes, birds sitting puffed up. And if you're seeing that, I recommend taking down your feeders, bleaching them in a one part bleach to 10 part water solution, and putting them away for a couple months until it gets cold again.
Bill, thanks for that call. And real quick, Rita, I wanted to turn to you because you have a question about a goldfinch in your yard.
Yes, I thought finches had to be attracted by a feeder, which I don't have. But I've noticed a pair coming for the first time, and they enjoy my beets. They are pecking at the greens, and I don't know if they're finding insects that I haven't seen or if it's the green itself.
Well, goldfinches are actually vegetarians. They don't take any insect food, and they don't feed any insect food to their young. So they tend to be attracted to things that are in seed, like flower gardens gone to seed. They love coneflowers, rudbeckia, that kind of thing. So I'm a little curious what a goldfinch would be doing pecking at beet leaves. That's odd.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
rather odd.
Yeah. Rita, thanks a lot for that question. Julie Zuckerfuss, we're just about out of time. It's been so great talking to you again, as usual.
Ew, yeah, always fun and great questions today. Wow, really put me through my paces.
Yeah, I know. It was a busy, busy day. And
yeah.
Once again, folks, we'll have links to Julie's website and her blog. I highly recommend it. It's wonderful reading and wonderful viewing, too. She's a great photographer as well. Julie Zuckerfuss, thanks as always. Appreciate your time. Take care.
Thank you, Ann.
Julie Zuckerfuss, artist, author, naturalist. Thanks to everybody again for those great questions and comments. Really enjoy hearing from the listeners as well. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.